Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. But it's more than mind power today. We're going to be talking about history power. Yes. Tomorrow, we are celebrating here in the United States Pearl Harbor Day. It's what Roosevelt called one of the most infamous days in American history. And for many, many people, that's very true. My guest today, Ken Putty, is a man who decided he was going to tell his dad's story. His father fought in the war. And the story is a very interesting one. He's put together two books. The first book is called Code, Named Sonny. And the other one is Mountains of Fire. How does one go about this? How are you going to be able to really get the facts on this? This, and we'll find out more from my guest today, Ken Putty. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Donna.
Ken, it's really a challenge, I think, when we have family members and they've been involved in war. I know in my own family when I was growing up, I had male relatives that they wouldn't even talk about the war. They'd say, don't even bring it up. They'd walk away from you. They wouldn't want to even discuss it. My husband's side of the family, many men served in the military in the past. Many different wars, and even up into the present, are very deeply involved in the military. And this seems to be a common attitude of many. How is it that you were able to get your dad to talk about his experiences? It's wonderful that you put this material together. What enabled you to be comfortable at doing this?
Well, you know, I've had many uncles who were in World War II and Korean War and such, and my dad was in World War II. We always knew him to be in the Navy, you know, an old tough Navy veteran was on in the Pacific in late 1944, early 1945. But it wasn't until New Year's Eve in 99 to 2000, my wife Kim and I figured, you know, let's go out with the old folks. We went to the Polish League of American Veterans dance and said, yeah, we'll go have some fun with the parents. And we had a blast, even though most 80 and 90-year-olds outdanced us to Glenn Miller and different other songs there, which was...
Oh, that's embarrassing.
Just a little bit. You know, I had my coat off, my tie off, and they're still dancing away in a full suit. And so we had a blast that night, and we went back. And my background is that I was a company commander in Desert Storm. I was an Army major, led a company into the desert. My proudest moment was bringing 75 people in and taking 75 people home. So my dad and I had that connection. We're the only ones in my core family that actually had military service in a wartime. And when we got back to the house, he said, why don't you come in for a nightcap? And we went in and we're talking. And my dad had given his time for years to the Catholic schools, and he would teach computers for free. He would set up networks with his own money in the school so the kids would have, you know, some computers to work with. And I said, you know, Dad, you're in your 70s. Why don't you just retire? You know, just go spend our inheritance money. Go have fun. You've done enough good work, and, you know, it's time to take a break. And he started to cry. And if you don't know some of these old veterans, you don't see that out of these guys at all. And my dad was, he was always a tough dad. He was a good dad. He just, you know, he's that kind of guy. He didn't even cry at my grandmother's funeral. So it took me by surprise, and I said, well, what's going on? And I think because I had that experience as well, he explained that he was behind enemy lines in France at 16 years old because he spoke fluent French to deliver radios to the partisans, the Free French and the Maquis partisans, which were the communist partisans, in support of Patton's fake invasion of Pas-de-Calais, which is called Operation Bodyguard. So having said all that, I've said, you know, why didn't you tell anybody about this? And he said, because if I'm still here, they're still here. And as you know, if you have relatives in World War II, especially, they just didn't want to talk about it. They wouldn't, none of them would talk about it. And I think the only catalyst or the only thing that was in common is that I was a war veteran too. And the same thing happened with my father-in-law, John Matus, who was flew 30 missions over Germany in a B-24, which is going to be a future book called Sugar Baby. But you know, he was able to talk to me as well. So I was talking to my dad. So I decided to write a book about it, and I wrote Codename Sonny. And Codename Sonny, I decided to tell his true story, but I want to add something to it in the modern portion of it, because a lot of us kids of World War II and Korean War veterans, or whatever war, want to find out what's going on. So I wrote the book Past Present. So the past mm-hmm. is the actual true story, and the present is the what if they found us, in respect to my dad saying if I'm still here, they're still here. So the present version of it, you know, it goes past, present, chapters. The present is the they found us.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want my listeners to know that you have quite extensive background in education. You did spend 13 years in military service in the Army, and you were a major. You also, as you said, served as a company commander during Desert Shield and Desert Storm. You won the Bronze Star, the Kuwait Liberation Medal, and the Combat Air Medal. Your book has won a number of awards, and I think it's so good that these stories are coming out. I think it is not just a privilege to be able to talk about men like your dad, but I think it's important for us to understand that one of the things that America represents to the entire world on so many levels is an aspect of freedom that very few places on this planet have. I was discussing it early this morning with my husband before he had to leave for a meeting. And I thought, the more educated I become, the more people I interview, and I've interviewed thousands of people on my shows, I am so aware of how precious freedom really is. And in your story, Codename Sonny, the words you just mentioned, they're still out there. It almost makes someone think, is this bordering paranoia? No, it is not. There's always going to be that component of the human creature that's going to say, I want what you have, or you do not have the right to this. It's an ongoing battle. It's a daily battle. And it's something that, again, America has always represented to other people, the freedom of possibility. Nobody guarantees you anything. But you would have the right to make your choices. You would have the right to say no to what you didn't want, and so much more. This story is really intriguing because your dad was so young, 16 years old. But we have to go back to that time frame. A 16-year-old then was a man, considered
Correct.
A man. There really wasn't anything like a teenager. The teenage years, the teenager, the term, actually came about in the 30s and 40s. When you were growing up in that time frame, you had to be responsible. Life was not sweetness and chocolate ice cream, thank you very much. No, many children had to work so that their families would have food on the table if they were lucky. Your dad was a very industrious person, and in this book, even though it's in a fictional context, the facts of what you have here about what really went on in the war, this is just well done. When you were doing this, Ken, you're a veteran, what kind of emotions did you go through with this publication?
Oh, that was very tough, and a lot of it was, and I joke about it, but it's kind of the way we had to get it out. Dad and I sat down with a bottle of bourbon a few times and discussed it, and there were many tears talking about, and I think it's the emotions of combat, and some people, it's partially maybe PTSD, mm-hmm. combat stress, and a lot of times when I'm putting this down and writing it, especially when he talks about the little 10-year-old girl that died in his arms when he was in France, a little Jewish girl that died in his arms by the name of Charlene, and I always mention her name because I always want to honor her, who was beaten up by the Gestapo to find them, to find their partisan team. So those kind of emotions, and people who have read the book have said, you know, I've cried, I've laughed, I got angry, and I figure if I hit all those emotions, then I've got some success in it, because I wanted to put out, you know, why, how these people felt and what they went through was nothing that I think any of the kids today will ever experience, like, hopefully.
I have yet to meet a military man or woman, anyone really, that has ever had the experience of war, that glorifies it. I've never met anybody. In fact, I find those that maybe will want to glorify it in some way, they've never really lived it.
No.
I just think that what you portray in this book about the various people, the human side of the reality, of the ugliness of it. And one of the things that you bring out in Codename Sunny is the underground. And when I was growing up, I can remember hearing about it. And, of course, well, I remember when the people in Hungary, it was big, big, big news where they were taken over by the Soviets. Now, this is sort of going right past the time frame you're talking about, but I want to blend it in. The humans that are out there, the people, no matter where they are in the world, saying, I'd rather be free than be a slave to a system. And they would prefer to die than to not fight for what they believe in. And I thought, this is pretty powerful stuff. This is really not a lot you hear about. If someone happens to introduce you to a good Marlene Dietrich movie, or some old movies of World War II, they bring it out a little bit. I think there was one done by Spencer Tracy that was just very powerful. It was all about one person's survival because of this incredible network of people who put right their lives at risk every moment of the day. And this is something that you give a lot of information about. You also talk about aspects of how the French, they had this tremendous underground, but also that there was a group of the French people that did everything they could to support the Nazis. And you had a certain term for them. What was that term?
It's the Vichy. It's the Vichy French.
Okay.
The milice, which meant gray mice, because they wore gray uniforms, la milice, and I know my French editor is telling me I'm not pronouncing it right, but I actually, how I got that information is I ran across a lady who grew up in south of France, whose relatives at the Christmas table, half of them were Vichy French that supported the Nazis, and the other half were worked with the Free French, and this is in the 50s, and there were big fistfights at the table because one supported the Nazis and one was trying to get Free France. So it's just a really interesting, you know, conversations that she was telling me about that they would have at the table. Well, maybe not interesting, but definitely one for a book. And I used her expertise and her knowledge of the country and what was going on because she was growing up in the 50s and spoke the French that's being spoken, that was spoken in the war. And if you go back now today and you have somebody translating French now, then it's not going to be the same. So I try to get that authenticity into it as well.
Boy, that's where recording the history is so significant. And what you were able to do with your dad, and I think, again, because you have that compatibility of being a veteran and having walked the path of war yourself, it's quite significant. The first one, Codename Sunny, is really gripping because it is just amazing how you were able to put into this book your dad's journey, but also to create an awareness that we have to be on guard. We must be alert that there always is going to be some kind of hate or poison that of thought or lust for power that individuals will always have, and we have to be vigilant, period. Your second book, Mountains of Fire, and this really makes a very good package. Why did you decide to make two books instead of putting everything together in one?
Well, actually, I wanted to tell Dad's story and cut it off at a certain point because the impact of telling just his story and stopping, you know, when he left the theater of war and went back back to England and eventually back to the United States, is that I thought it had a greater impact. Just so the readers, your readers know, and your listeners know, is I'm actually working on a project to combine the two books to make a greater book and expand the first book to include some more information I found out about Dad, and he passed away last year, unfortunately, but I found out some more information when he was behind enemy lines, stuff that he had written down and hidden, and I found it, you know, going through his stuff.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, so it's real hooks in there that just real surprising information that I didn't know. So I will combine the two eventually, but separately they still make good novel because Mountains of Fire starts the second Codename Sunny Ends. Literally the second. And the last scene in Codename Sunny is pretty much starts the first scene in Mountains of Fire. And it's a past present as well. And as you've read it, it's basically whoever's left, who Sunny left behind, now has to find a way out of France. Because they were compromised, which was very common.
Now, one of the aspects of both of your books that I really, really enjoy is that you present certain points of information about what else is going on. When you look at Europe, when you think about the war, everything is so tight together. You know, England, Germany, France, all of these countries are very, very closely associated. We take so much for granted today. And when Spain was going through its stuff, there's so much that overlaps. And to really get into history and to see how different dictators come in, certain flows occur from one environment into another, good, bad, or indifferent, economic concerns, all of this is very intriguing because it is like a humongous universal stage that has a gazillion plays going on all at the same time. And somehow or another, they weave together into this tapestry of happenings. And it's absolutely amazing how certain sides took certain positionings and groups within different companies, took their positionings. And you bring that out in your books. And the Nazis were quite pervasive, more so than anybody, I think, in today's world. I don't even know that we talk about in schools, but more than anybody can ever realize how pervasive they were.
Right. So one of the things I want to bring out when I'm writing a book, I don't want you being a microcosm where you're just focused on the characters without the greater aspect of the world going on around them, because it absorbed people in World War II. You know, they had to deal with all this as they were going through the war. And, for example, you're talking about different dictator stuff. In Spain, Spain was neutral, but they were still fascist. And so they supported Hitler in the beginning of the war. And Mountains of Fire is named after the goddess Pyrene, who's the goddess of fire, and so they're named Mountains of Fire, but a lot of the French dissidents, Jewish families who needed to escape France from the Nazis, and political dissidents and partisans who were exposed and found out by the Gestapo had to flee, and there was only two ways to go, really. You'd go into Switzerland, but then you'd be out of the war, especially if you were a down pilot or, Frenchman. You'd be stuck in Switzerland forever. So they went down through into Spain, and at the beginning of the war, Spain would send them back if they caught you. Toward the end of the war, knowing that the Allies were winning, they'd kind of overlook it and let you go through the country. And one of the most important things there, and we're talking about the French culture, is they had passeurs, or, you know, guides, is what they call them. And the passeurs would lead these families and downed military pilots and partisans who needed to escape through the mountains at extreme risk. And, you know, if they were ever caught, they were just executed on the spot and killed mm-hmm. immediately. So, mm-hmm. you know, at great risk to themselves. And we're talking about our veterans, you know, going out there and sacrificing. Some of these people did it on a daily basis. And I think the number's around somewhere around 35,000 people escaped into Spain and through Spain.
Mm-hmm. And then they had to contend with whatever biases might be present in Spain. And that was another challenge. I just find the diversity in the human spirit as you presented in your second book, Mountains of Fire, most intriguing, because I think it is that diversity that makes us aware of how powerful, good, bad, or indifferent the spirit of that person might be, can literally change history. And that's one of the points that you bring out in the book about how it took this communication among people. And they didn't have cell phones. They didn't have anything like we've got today. And if they did, they probably wouldn't use them because they would be tracked. But it is understanding how to not just survive, but how relationships are built. And you weave a phenomenal love story in here in a wonderful way. You weave in the power of love itself, and how that impact is really one of the driving forces behind so many people. They hold life precious, and again, they refuse to be slaves. So it's something that you have taken and woven into your material from a perspective that I think really balances the male-female side. I was reviewing some material just last night, written by someone that I have a great deal of respect for, and I was observant of the fact that they did not give very much of the female side in their material. It was very, very much from a man's perspective, and I don't have anything against that. It was just an observation. In your book, I really have to compliment you, because you represented so many of the women in a way that showed that they were just as fierce as fighters as the men were.
Right. No, definitely in France. And if you, one of the characters, Lelaine, who's in the second book, Mountains of Fire, she was an actual partisan that had been shot by the Gestapo. Or actually, it was sniper killed her. And she was a sniper herself, mm-hmm. along with her sister, and they were teenagers. And they were fighting the Germans. So I put her in the book to honor her.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of my characters come from real people, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And this is something that I think is very important, because too often people do not see women as warriors. Well, how many times do you hear the remark, be careful, you get a mother angry, you've got a she-tiger here, she'll take and slit your throat in 2 seconds.
Yeah,
I mean, I heard that when I was growing up from so many people. You might be able to push a woman to a certain point, but there is going to be that point, and believe me, when she reaches it, you're going to wish to God you hadn't gotten there.
There's a lot like that. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, what I was going to say is, this is something that in your writing, presenting the part of the woman, there are so many people I know that, see, women shouldn't be in the military. You know, they think we're fluff heads, for God's sake, and I just don't get it. Because I can guarantee you, a female sharpshooter, they have discovered through research that many times the women can be better than the guys.
A lot of the partisan women in France during that time frame were snipers.
Mm-hmm.
So, they got something right there. You know, they were very effective, but, you know, it's a very dangerous business, too.
Well, it is. And I know my husband said to me, Donna, you just don't understand. The reason men go to war is because they're going to protect home and family. I thought to myself, and you think the women didn't during the Civil War? They didn't fight for what they had to fight for. I don't know why they have this idea we gals are out there with full skirts and fluffy hats, and we just have big brown or blue eyes or green eyes, and we're just going, duh. I don't think so.
Well,
I don't know.
I believe Lelaine had a skirt and a beret and a sniper rifle in one of the scenes, so.
Yeah, she was quite a character. Your book is, historically, there's so much good information in it. And I know there might be some of my listeners that are saying, Donna, why in the world do we want to read about war? Well, there's a fact about history, and I know my audience has heard this said before. Not me, necessarily, but others. If you are not willing to learn from history, if you're not willing to learn from the past, you're probably going to repeat the past again and again and again. And God knows, I know in my lifetime, the list of wars that have gone on around the globe, atrocious. In your lifetime, there is that level. Doesn't seem like we've learned very much as human beings. And that's a sad statement about it. But every generation needs to know these stories. Every generation needs to be aware of the men and women that really believe that they have the right to be free, and they were willing to do everything necessary to be there. And it was very painful. There's nothing romantic about it. There's nothing that you can just paint it and glitter it with gold. No, you have to look, I think, at the truth. But at the same time, with all of the horror of war, and this is another thing that you bring out with your books, Codenamed Sunny and Mountains of Fire, there's love stories, there are stories of compassion and care and concern, dedication, commitment, honor, integrity, all of these components and even more. It's truly a fascinating read, because in these two books, you have combined so much of that. And I think your father is probably very pleased that you were able to share his story. And if he's like some of the relatives that I have, he says, nah, it's no big deal. But every person, I think, has something to leave behind in the way of a legacy. And I think what you have done, Ken Pody, is just marvelous. And I want to just say thank you very much for doing that. Now, people can go to your website, which is kenpody.net, and that's spelled P-O-T-T-I-E.net, and they can find out more about your book. And you've got another one that you've got coming out, and this is about your dad's papers that you just found.
Right.
Wow, it looks like you're going to be busy for a while.
Yeah, I am, and the 13th cohort is the third book in the series coming out next month, and that has to do with Himmler and his SS castle and the Spear of Destiny, which was the spear that pierced the side of Jesus when he was on the cross, which was stolen by Hitler from a Vienna, Austria museum when he annexed Austria.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they stole so much. They just robbed everybody.
But I think just this year they found a World War II veteran Nazi who he had millions of dollars of paintings in his house, and nobody could figure out why nobody checked. So.
Well, and that's it. That's in a lot of private collections. And I had a client that went down to South America, and she said that she had gone into places where there were these phenomenal treasures that she knew came from World War II. And
right.
She said she didn't want to buy any of them, but it was a particular environment in South America, and she said they were more or less protected, and they had been that way for a long time,
long time.
Well, Ken, I want to thank you again. I wish you and your family a great holiday season. Thank you for being my guest today.
Thank you for having me on, Donna.
It's been a pleasure. Check it out, Mountains of Fire, Codenamed Sunny. Picture of his dad is on a Swiss book, 16 years old. When he went in for life experience, well, you'll know more about the story if you read the book. Tremendous read. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat after we come back from a break. We'll be right back.
Have you ever had a paranormal experience, such as seeing a ghost, having precognitive dreams, out-of-body experiences, or other happenings? If so, Donna would like to hear from you. She's putting together a book of 100 stories from people who would like to tell their story. If you'd like to submit yours, send an email to donna@delphiinternational.com. Again, send your story to donna@delphiinternational.com. Be sure to include your contact information as well. Thank you. Do you have a product or service that you would like people to know about? Internet radio is a powerful medium that can assist you in reaching people who like to shop online and pass by electronic word of mouth information about you, your products, and or services. The Donna Sebo Show reaches around the world, and you can be part of that enterprising network. For more information, contact Vision Broadcasting via donna@delphiinternational.com.
Or call 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Well, is the ho-ho-ho spirit getting to you? I am having so much fun with it. I don't know about you. I love this time of the year. It's really cold here in the Pacific Northwest. For us, anyway, it's in the 20s. You may be someplace else on the planet where it's 130. I don't know. But where we are, it is cold. But it's perfect for this time of the year, and people have decorations going up like crazy. It's just marvelous, absolutely marvelous. And I'm going to be sharing a cookie recipe with you later on. It's really, really easy, and it's got a fun story behind it, so I will share that with you later on. But I wanted to talk about something that occurred in the past, and it had to do with being an ultimate survivor. But you know what? I think instead of that one, I want to talk about this guy. Yeah, I love spooky stories. I don't know about you, but I love stories that are odd, that are unusual, that don't have any real logic to them. This is one of them. And I was reminded about this, and I thought, okay, let me share this story with you today. This occurred on November 16th of 1905 in North Carolina, USA. Now, there was a gentleman by the name of James Chaffin. He was a very, very wealthy man. Now, before he died, apparently, he made a mistake, and he would end up having to come back to correct the mistake. Do you believe in life after death? I do. Well, that's not the end of the story. This is what happened. He had a wife and four children. There was a point where, as a responsible person, he drew up a will that left his entire estate to his third and favorite son. And the son's name was Marshall. Well, the rest of the family wasn't too happy with his decision, but they said, all right, he's an old man, he's got all of these weird idiosyncrasies, and one of those weird idiosyncrasies he had was an old coat. He would wear it constantly. Now, that old coat was so ragged, his wife couldn't talk him out of it. Nope, that is what he was going to wear. Well, 16 years after he had made this will, leaving all of his estate to his third son, Marshall, Chaffin was quite elderly. He ends up tripping down a set of stairs, and he dies. Now, the uncontested will went through probate. It was done. However, 4 days after Mr. Chaffin died, the second son, James, was disturbed by a very vivid dream in which his father appeared at his bedside, and he was gesturing to a pocket in this old ragged coat that he wore all the time before he died. This dream was so vivid that at breakfast, James told his wife and his mother about this apparition of his father that appeared to him in the dream. And when they were talking about it, they said, well, why is he pointing to the coat? He said he wasn't just pointing to the coat. He was pointing to a pocket in his coat. Well, they started discussing among themselves who got the coat. Nobody liked the thing. It was ragged. I'm surprised somebody didn't throw it out. Well, they remembered the eldest son had been given the coat. Surprisingly, that which the eldest son had gotten as part of the estate, he had put up in the attic. They said, let's go get the coat. They told him about the dream, and this is what they found. When they pulled this old worn coat out of wherever it had been dumped in the attic, when they started opening it up, the pocket that had been pointed to by Mr. Chafin in the dream to his second son, James, they found that there were stitches all around the pocket. They were very large, done in a very clumsy manner. And what they did, they opened up the pocket and found inside a piece of paper that had been rolled very, very tightly. On that piece of paper, it said, read the 27th chapter of Genesis in my daddy's old Bible. Now, Mrs. Chafin said, you know, your dad had put that old, old Bible, it was falling apart, put it away years ago. Now, because this was so strange, they contacted some of their neighbors, and they said, come along with us. We need witness. This is what we found. So they said, sure. The old guy was really weird in the things that he did, so we'll be glad to be witness to anything. So there was a Mr. Blackwelder and his daughter joining the members of the Chafin family, and they went and pulled out this old, old family Bible. Now, when they pulled it out, they found that it had been wrapped very, very carefully. Very, very thoughtfully, they unwrapped the papers around this, and they found in this old Bible two pages that had been glued together. Very carefully, they opened up those pages, and inside those glued pages, which were separated very carefully,
caller,
they found another will. That's right. 2 years before Mr. Chafin had died, he'd written another will. And in this will, he stated that the estate was to be divided equally among his children and wife. They took it to court. It stood up, went uncontested. The family members were quite happy. What do you think of that story? We've got a caller on the line. This is Donna Siebel. If you want to chat with me, 888-627-6008. Caller, welcome to the show, and thank you for waiting so patiently. First name or initial, and where are you calling in from?
Patricia, and I'm calling from Arizona.
Hi, Patricia. Happy holidays to you. Patricia, when I'm watching you, I'm seeing that you don't have a lot of time to play. You have got 1, 2, 3, 4 items that are simmering on a back burner, and you have to make sure you keep your eye on them. You are going to be in for some lifestyle changes in 2014. I think you're going to find that those lifestyle changes are going to be quite meaningful to you. And what I would like for you to do is to be attentive. Do not drop the ball. Follow through with all the little tiny steps that you need to do with each one of these projects. And just keep them prioritized, because you're going to have to shift the priority with them, the priority positioning with them as necessary. But you will reach your goal. So it's probably going to be reached a good segment of the goal that you're trying to aspire towards. you'll be able to reach by, I think, the 2nd to the 15th of February. But you must follow through. Even though we're in a very colorful, dynamic holiday time of the year, business has to still be taken care of. So pay attention, keep up whatever it is that you need to do, if it's phone calls, if whatever, and I think you'll be very happy with the results. You're going to find yourself coming into 2014 with a sense of not just optimism, but practical application of what you know you need to do. What would you like to ask me today?
Nothing. You touched on everything.
Oh, I love it when I do that. I don't know that I'm doing it, but thank you. That's very, very nice. Where are you in Arizona?
Yeah. In the Tucson area, and it's cold.
The desert, that's one thing people don't realize many times, is how cold the desert can get. But it's great, I think, for this time of the year. Absolutely wonderful. So have a wonderful holiday season. Enjoy yourself immensely. Count your blessings. And just know that a lot of good is coming your way.
I just have to do the work. You know, yes, I have fallen by the wayside and lost things, lost projects, because I didn't follow through. And thank you very much for reminding me.
I think any of us can be guilty of that. But in your case, even though I'm looking at four projects simmering, remember they're simmering. So you've got to keep an eye on them so that they don't burn. They don't evaporate out and away. So just what you said is a compliment to that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Donna.
You're welcome, dear. You take care now.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You, too.
This is Donna Sebo, and you can give me a buzz if you like, 888-627-6008. Well, I wanted to share a recipe with you. If you're like me, there's just something about the smell of gingerbread, cooking in the kitchen, making cookies. I know I'm going to be busy with all kinds of things because I've got a stockpile. My goodies, there's friends and family that I'm going to be giving this yummy items too. And of course, I have to hide them. I had a chuckle. We had a neighbor come over just a couple of days ago, and we were laughing at him because I said, would you like to have some of this? Would you like to have some of that? And my husband said to his friend visiting, he said, well, Donna hides these things from me. And he said, when you come over, then I get to have some. And the guy said, don't feel bad. My wife does the same thing. And I thought, how many of us wives hide stuff from our families? Say, we're going to get it done. We are going to get it done, bud. You are going to be in deep trouble if we find you in there munching, because it's for such and such a holiday. And it brings back memories, you know, when I'm sharing this with you, it brings back memories of a conversation that I had with a friend of mine who is Norwegian. And every Christmas, she said it was really a big deal. The women in her family would get together, and there were certain machines. She had a type of a basement in her house, and this was in California, which basements are not very common in California, at least not in my neighborhood. And the women, they lived in a very old house, and she said, my family would come over, and we'd start right at the first part of December. And we'd start putting everything together, and there were certain machines for rolling out doughs. And this goes back, she said, a long, long time. And the women would take about a full week. They'd come over and have a great time, and they'd bake the breads and the cookies and all kinds of things. And she said it was so much fun because the children were invited, and they were included in this, and they all had a part in the responsibility. Of course, they got to sample a few of the goodies, the broken cookies. You know how that goes. And then the rest were all saved. And she said it really made the preparation for the holidays very special. And when I came across this one recipe, and I was gifted this array of recipes by a Norwegian woman that I met in the 90s, and I really treasure her book because it just has so many wonderful feelings. I don't have any Norwegian in me. I don't have that Scandinavian background. But I just thoroughly have enjoyed the environments like Solvang in California, Leavenworth here in the state of Washington, where that cultural aspect is honored. And this particular recipe is called the Poor Man's Cookies. Now, what she said is, don't be fooled by the name. These are not a poor man's cookies, because for us today, it's an expensive cookie to make. And she said, in the original recipes that were passed down to her, it called for as many as 24 to 30 eggs minus a few whites. And she said the reason it was called the poor man's cookie is that she figured that if you made these cookies often, you'd end up broke. Now, even though in their world there was an abundance of butter and milk and this type of thing, still, it was an expensive cookie. And this recipe was enjoyed very much by the farm people. And she said this goes back to before the mid-19th century. And she said at Christmas time, it was a traditional must to have in on your table for your guests and your family. And she said it keeps wonderfully if you want to make it in advance. It's one of these recipes. It will keep beautifully, just like shortbread cookies. And don't forget, in my last newsletter, if you didn't get my newsletter, go to my website, and you'll find an absolutely incredible shortbread recipe. It is delicious. You have to work hard at it, but it's good. Uh-oh, before I get into this, let's take a quick break. I'll be right back.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedros accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny. They will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Okay, here we go. I want to give you the recipe for the poor man's cookies. Now, again, this is a Norwegian favorite. You're going to need, and everything needs to be at room temperature. You're going to need 7 egg yolks. You're going to need 1/2 cup of sugar. And I like the extra fine. That's my bias. But 1/2 cup of sugar. 1 cup of whipping cream. Now, the type of cream makes a difference. You want to make sure you have the whipping cream. You're going to need 1/4 teaspoon of lemon peel, freshly grated. 2 tablespoons of cognac. Now, if you don't have cognac, if you want to put in another liquor, you can. Or you try something else. And then you're going to need 2 2/3 cups of flour. And then you're going to need 1/4 teaspoon of cardamom, as well as some shortening. I like butter. Traditionally, lard was used, which is excellent, by the way. You might want to try coconut oil. Coconut oil is very solid until you heat it. So it's a very good shortening to use. So you've actually got 3 options. Now, this is what you do. Now, let me repeat the ingredients again. 7 egg yolks, 1/2 cup of sugar, 1 cup of whipping cream, 1/4 teaspoon of lemon peel grated, 2 tablespoons of cognac, 2 2/3 cups of flour, approximately, 1/4 teaspoon of cardamom, and also you're going to need some shortening. Now, you beat your egg yolks and sugar until they're nice and light and fluffy. Your whipped cream, you're going to beat separately until it's very, very firm. And you add it then to the eggs together with the lemon peel and the cognac. You then are going to add your cardamom to your flour and sift it into your mixture, keeping out a little flour to sprinkle over the dough and some to roll the dough out with. Now, you're not going to need to be heavy with flour here. You're going to use it lightly. And then what you do is you make it into a little square or a little ball, roll it up into your Saran wrap, and then stick it in the refrigerator. You're not going to work with it until the next day. So this is something that you can make in advance, make your dough in advance, put it in the refrigerator. If you want to make a couple of batches, you can. Put it in the refrigerator. Let it marry its flavors and content. And then, when you're ready to bake, have your baking sheets all ready to go. You are going to find that this is going to make about, let me see here. It's going to make about 7.5 dozen. Now, when it comes to your shortening, because these are cookies that you are going to fry in shortening, so you're going to need to have a good-sized skillet. A cast iron skillet is perfect for this, and it needs to be deep. What you're going to do, you take a small portion of your dough, you place it on a lightly floured surface, roll it until it's thin, you cut it into diamond shapes, and the Norwegians have certain cutters that they like to use, but you make your choice the way you want to do it. And then you make a slit about 1 1/8 inch long in the middle and carefully take a corner of your dough. You're going to make these little diamond shapes. And you make a slit in the center, and you take one corner of that diamond shape and put it into that slit. And just very lightly sprinkle it with flour. Not much, just lightly. You're shortening in your pan. I like coconut oil. You can get that to a pretty good heat. When that oil is hot, you drop these cookies in. They're going to swell. They'll develop air bubbles during the cooking. When they're golden brown, you lift them up and out. Drain them well on paper towels. And if you like, you can sprinkle it with confectionery sugar. They are wonderful. They're light. They're delicious. And if you want to add a little bit of extra flavor to it, open up a vanilla pod. Scrape out the seeds and put them in the dough. That's going to give it an extra punch of flavor. If you're getting ready to do some baking and you'd like to have a stronger taste of vanilla in the sugar, take a batch of sugar and just stick a vanilla pod in that sugar, close it up, let it be, and the vanilla pod will flavor your container of your sugar with its vanilla fragrance. It is just wonderful. Just a couple of little tips there for you. But check them out, Poor Man's Cookies. They're wonderful with coffee and tea. And yes, they are light, but they are going to travel well if you put them in tins. They are very good. But I don't know that they're as hardy as shortbread if you're going to be sending cookies a long distance. Shortbread is awesome for shipping. They really stand up well. And there's a lot of other good cookies that do the same. Well, I know we're getting close to the end of the show, and I want to let you know about my guests that are going to be coming up next week. We're going to be talking about a woman, Frances Key, and her paranormal experiences with her mom after she passed away. It's called The Team, A Mother's Wisdom from the Other Side. And then Robbie Holtz we're going to be speaking with on Tuesday, Secrets of Aboriginal Healing. Phenomenal story. This is a physicist we're going to be talking with. And then Coaching for Caregivers, Yosel August, if you're one of those people or if you know someone needs some help. America Needs America's Energy, Mark Stansberry. Out of Style, we're going to be touching in on the history of fashion and how we got to where we are today with Betty Schubert. Wonderful, diverse subject matter. I think you'll have a good time. Won't you join me at the broadcasting table here at the Donna Sebo Show? Thank you so much for being with me today. We'll be chatting again. Have an awesome day or evening wherever you are on this phenomenal planet of ours. God bless. We'll be talking again soon. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.